Welcome to The Syndicate, that mysterious crossroads between the cinema screen and the corridors of the mind, where today we traverse the haunting realm of Stalker by Andrei Tarkovsky. My name is Armand, and I am joined by Diego and Mike as we peel back the layers of this cerebral masterpiece. Within the confines of the zone, a space that defies reality, we reflect on human longing, a search for meaning, and the intersection of environment and psyche that Tarkovsky paints so vividly. As we dissect the film's poetic slow burn, we'll also glance at its implications on society, technology, and the boundless human spirit. So tune in as we discuss the artistry and enigma of Tarkovsky's world here on The Syndicate.
Welcome to The Syndicate, a film and TV podcast. Be a part of the conversation as industry insiders, genre lovers, and cinephiles dare to peek beyond the curtains of imagination and dive into the art of cinema. Join us as we want you to spend less time scrolling and more time watching. Now here's your host, Armand Haddad.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are back from our slumber. We're back in the studio. We got Diego, the genre lover. We got Mike, the cinephile. And Mike subjected us to a new film that I've never seen before, Stalker by Andrei Tarkovsky.
Yeah.
And before we get into it, Diego, you didn't watch this movie.
Damn it. Why did you do that? I literally was thinking there was one thing Armand didn't have to do is that. But we're here. And yes, I haven't seen it. But honestly, I'm here for the conversation. Andrei Tarkovsky is like a very prolific director. He's very thoughtful. So, you know, I'm here for the introspective conversation.
I'm ready too.
Awesome.
So, Mike, I want to get the ball rolling on this movie.
Mm-hmm. The history of
who is Andrei Tarkovsky? Who is Andrei
Tarkovsky?
Who is Tarkovsky?
You can think of it like what's the Star Wars term, like Tarko? It's
Grand Moff Tarkin.
Yeah, Grand Moff Tarkin. That's how I remember how to pronounce it. Nice. Tarkovsky. Yeah. So Tarkovsky is a Soviet director. Nowadays he would be Russian, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And but he died before the Soviet Union fell. So I think he's pretty bona fide Soviet. He was born after it formed and he died before it fell. Didn't live very long, and it's actually partially because of that movie, but this movie Stalker, but I'll go into that a little bit more later. He was a very like sort of spiritual, temporal kind of guy. Originally wanted to be a photographer, a musician, sort of looked into these things and chose being a filmmaker very late. It wasn't really like a childhood dream. It was something he picked in college. And on its face, his filmography seems to very much not have a lot of consistency. You see historical fiction, you see science fiction, fantasy, autobiography, but he actually sort of has a common theme throughout all of it, at least in my opinion, of he covers a lot of ground on like what it means to be with others and what it means to be alone and what it means to sort of find yourself or find what you want in others. And I think Stalker really covers that to the same degree that completely different genres of his cover it, like The Mirror or Andrei Rublev or any of that.
Right.
So I actually found him during lockdown when I was kind of alone. So it sort of aesthetically fit. Yeah. You watch these movies and like the characters often feel very alone even when they're in a crowd. And that was kind of what lockdown felt like to me. So it clicked really heavily with me and I got into this guy.
Did you feel like you were a stalker? You kind of are a stalker.
Well, a stalker by the movie definition. Yes. Yeah. We should clarify what a stalker is in the movie. So
okay.
So the main character, without going into anything else about the movie,
right,
the main character is sort of a guy who can see things that others cannot see that can be wondrous or dangerous and sort of guides these other people through these dangerous areas, right, and helps them avoid that. And so they, in this world of the movie, those people who can see these traps and dangers are called stalkers, and they're sort of an illegal profession they establish that in the opening scene of the movie, that he's sort of risking his life and his family's life by doing this, but that he can't help but do it.
Right.
And he, it's almost, as the movie goes on, it becomes kind of an almost spiritual thing. It starts very material, what the dangers are,
right,
and then progressively becomes more like temporal or spiritual. And, you know, we talked a little bit before we started this podcast about how Denis Villeneuve, you know, director of the Dune movies and Blade Runner 2049, stylistically borrows a lot, but also uses a lot of sort of talking about things that are not on screen, or using the denial of information to make to use wonder as a storytelling device, to make the viewer wonder what is going on when they can't outright see it, you know?
Cause like Stalker, I put it on when I watched it and I was like, holy shit, this movie's 3 hours long.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, you feel it. Because, like, he lingers on shots. I shit you not, Diego.
Mm-hmm.
This dude is walking through a tunnel for 6 minutes.
Yeah.
Six minutes?
It's like one shot, I believe. Or it's like going
over
back
his shoulder.
And forth.
Yeah. Uh-huh. In front of me. It's like crunch, crunch. And I'm like, no, how long is this taking? Oh my God. Six. And then there's another scene where they're sitting, they're still underground. They're sitting by a pool of water for, I shit you not, 4 minutes straight.
Yeah.
Huh. No dialogue.
Okay.
All these scenes are no dialogue. And then there's this other scene where it's like this beautiful panning shot over like a pond with a whole bunch of debris in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's 4 minutes long too of no dialogue. But he does that so you meditate on what you're looking at and also to get into the headspace of the characters.
So, and then now when you say like it's just like this over the shoulder shot, like is it like where it's moving, you know, he's kind of looking around the tunnel. Is the tunnel like pitch black, almost in a sense where it's like a sensory deprivation kind of feeling?
There's a trap. There might be a trap that he can't see, smell, or hear that may just instantly kill him.
Wow. Okay.
So, yeah, you're with the characters every step of the way, going into the zone.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie Stalker, I say you're a stalker, Mike, because like, the stalker character is like, okay, there's these zones where these meteorites fell, and there's this room where all of your wishes will come true.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the way to get there. It's forbidden. We have to go through like lines of defenses of like soldiers, but I know how to get through them. And that's what you do with movies. You're like, come into my movie room. Whoa, what's this? Well, that's Wong Kar Wai. Oh,
yeah, funny. I mean, I think that Tarkovsky has a philosophy about film, and we briefly just watched a video. You know, there's a million of these video essays on YouTube about this guy, but, you know, one of them, I think it was the one we just watched by the Like Stories of Old Guy, he's taking quotes from Tarkovsky's autobiography, and he really wants to focus on time and cinema. He's not focusing on spectacle. He's not focusing on, even when he focuses on photography, it's because he wants to make you look. And he's often not giving you something very beautiful. He's giving you something that you have to watch that only gains value as it changes within a single shot. Like where a character walks or the way that their mood changes. And so he's very much enamored with the power of like time in cinema. And it's not something you think about a lot because, you know, especially in like Hollywood style films, you want to use time efficiently, effectively. And so we tend to think of like a movie that if it's good, it's holding our attention and it's very full the whole time it's going.
Right.
And Tarkovsky's not that way. He'll kind of drag you through the crap. You know, he'll very much drag you through the way that like Zen music will, or the way that like, you know, interior design that's meant to be brutalist and minimalist is. He's doing that by asking you to hang on to what is the most important thing in a particular second or moment with this movie. And he does it not just in Stalker, he does it in other movies, but he takes this methodology, and I think essentially his whole career is seeing how flexible and how wide it can be. He's like, can I do it in science fiction? Can I do it in history? Can I do it in a World War II movie about a kid, you know, or a medieval painter?
Why do you think that is? Why is he doing that?
Because
he wanted to be a photographer, right? And photography is all about the instant moment in time that you're capturing.
Yeah.
And is applying that to cinema?
Well, I think I want to say that it's a product of everything he was raised on. So his father was a poet, and I think poetry is one of the, like, I think it's really the only form of literature that makes you aware of rhythm and pacing, and it plays such a primary role that if you ignore it, you're either not a poet anymore, or you're just really, you know, on your game and subverting whatever you're trying to do, right? So he's raised by a poet father, and he's also raised in a very, very tumultuous time in history. He's raised during the purges of Stalinism and World War II. And if you watch his autobiography, The Mirror, he goes into that, but also kind of what he reveals, and you could probably guess this without watching The Mirror, is that to him, a lot of life is just about watching moments pass by and trying to realize within the imminently mundane what is transcendentally important. If I'm looking at everyday things, or even like the garbage of the world, what actually is important? Because, you know, I don't just mean transcendental things like, ooh, the meaning of life or God or something like that. But if you see a group of people, how do you know that they're holding a trial or a wedding or a party? Because those are all just arrangements of people. Maybe you could look for props, and that would be a really easy way to explain it. But more delicately, you need to make sense of like many, many elements and not really focus on any particular one, but the big idea they're building together, you know? And that idea pops up in a lot of things. It pops up in, like, you know, all of that, like, sort of Iron Age philosophy that gets into what transcendental ideas are, like Platonism or Buddhism, which subverts it and refers to everything as empty. But it's the same thing that I don't think it's an artistic thing. I think it's a thing about attention and nuance, where how can you over time pay attention to many different things so that they become one unifying thing?
And
that's all over this movie. That's like, you're watching it and you're like, so what? These guys are, you know, they're driving through a bunch of garbage, but they're really revealing what each character, the way they handle problems, the way they handle danger, how they are virtuous, how they are cowardly. And that then, if you remember that, it kind of builds up in the next scene that you see them in, which is also very sparse, but combined with what you just watched, builds into something.
So the Stalker is taking three characters into the Forbidden Zone.
Two characters. Yeah.
It was supposed to be three, but he was like, because like one of the guys was like, I'm going to bring this girl in. And he's like, what the fuck's wrong with you? No.
Yeah. He keeps trying to bring things that will make him. I mean, that's an interesting thing to note at the beginning. The writer tries to bring alcohol, women, and cigarettes into the zone. And, you know, the Stalker's kind of like, what the fuck are you doing? Don't do this. Right. Like, you know, and like makes him dump out the alcohol, doesn't let him, I think the scientist doesn't let him get the cigarettes. And he literally has a car with the girl too. And he's like, no, don't take that nice car. Don't take the girl in the fur coat. We're going to like crawl through some shit. Like it's about to get real, you know? And what I really like about this movie, going back to the idea of transcendentalism, and I think, that plays into like, you know, the idea of Neoplatonism and how things get progressively more transcendental, is that the dangers get that way too. At the very beginning, you're explained very vocally, it's handed to you, how this is dangerous. And then this next part, they're trying to get through a military blockade. Also somewhat obvious, you have to pay attention, but it's still there. Yeah. Then the danger becomes about immediate environmental dangers that you can still see. And then it becomes about environmental dangers you can't see. And then it becomes, at the very end, the danger is essentially about the intentions of the people and like what they intend to do with that.
So we go from the physical danger to the danger that we can't see, like radiation or chemicals or poison. To a metaphysical danger, and then the danger within ourselves, within other humans.
Yeah, I would say the phase after the visible physical danger becomes the invisible yet imminent physical danger. It's still there, but then the problem, and especially not to give it away for Diego, but like what the scientist's aims are, or the problem with the way that the writer approaches life, these become the real dangers left after they can navigate all of this other stuff. That's the big thing left. And if this movie was like on, you know, TNT or TBS and you caught it while doing the dishes and you caught the end of it, you know, you could catch the end of Return of the Jedi and get a pretty good idea of like what the stakes are. but the stakes are so obfuscated and building on each scene that watching this movie partway through feels worthless, right? You feel like you're watching a ceremony in a language you don't understand for a ritual you don't care about, you know? So that's to me something that I really like about it.
Here's the thing. Because I'm watching this film and I'm like, what's the point of this movie? Because, like, first of all, Diego, you don't know this. It was based off of a 1972 Soviet novel called Roadside Picnic. And I read a little bit of it. And this film is loosely based on, I say loosely because it has nothing to do with the book.
Okay.
Because the book is about, it's about stalkers taking people into forbidden zones for crash sites of where UFOs crashed. And they're going there for crash retrievals, like trying to like, take the technology.
Cool.
And that hits different today because of what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. But Stalker, they changed that. Tarkovsky changed it. Instead of going to crash sites of UFOs, changed it to meteorites. And this room that we end up seeing grants your wish. Kind of like we're going to, like, I don't know, Agrabah or the treasure cave to find the genie.
Yeah.
Mike, why did they make that huge? That's a massive change. We're going from like hard sci-fi, aliens and all that stuff to this abstract idea of like, oh, all your wishes will come true if you go in this room.
Very Annihilation-esque.
Yes. I saw Annihilation after this, and I thought it was like Stalker with training wheels, honestly.
It's a ripoff movie.
Yeah. Well, Annihilation's also based on a book that has a very different tone, same thing, very different tone, very different aesthetic. And I haven't read the Annihilation book, so I'm not going to say anything about it. I haven't read
the movie is better.
Annihilation's a series too. I think it's based off of three books.
Yes.
But its focus isn't like an extraction group, as I understand it. It's more about people's relationship with nature, right? Like in the books.
Yeah, it kind of has something to do with it's similar in the sense of this cosmic energy. More than it is like trying to, I guess, like, no, there are senses of like understanding and whatnot. Is everyone kind of goes in with their own personal motives, or you kind of find out this energy pulls out those motives in like very cosmic horror-esque waves, just like Stalker.
Just like Stalker.
Well, and I think it's interesting to note that this is not the first science fiction film where Tarkovsky kind of like strip the plot down and then rebuilt the focus, right? There's also Solaris, also a really good movie of his, a lot more explicitly science fiction, but it's longer, and I don't blame anyone who doesn't
longer. Watch it. Longer?
It's longer than this movie?
Yeah, but they split it into a part one and part two where there's like an intermission where you're supposed to take a piss and get popcorn. Like, but you could really get a summary of the premise of Solaris and then just start watching part two and you wouldn't miss a lot because it's I like Solaris because it feels like the era of like Isaac Asimov and Lev, what's his name, who did this
Kubrick?
The author, he did
it's he a did Russian
book,
name
Solaris.
Russians.
Well, no, Russian, I think name. He's Polish, actually. It is like a Slavic
Eastern name. European.
But there's a lot of really, oh, see, now we have this going on, a mute in the background. Now they've entered the zone and suddenly it's in color and you've been watching this movie that you've almost forgotten is in black and white, and then it's in this lush color.
I want to talk about that really quick.
Let's pivot towards that.
There's a purpose of why, because like before we started recording, Mike, you were like, oh, this is like analogous to Wizard of Oz. And I was like, how so? And you're like, well, when Dorothy opens up the door from Kansas into the world of Oz, it becomes Technicolor.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, Mike, you know why this happens in Stalker, right? And you're like,
I didn't know.
No. And I was like, because, Diego,
they
re-recorded this film three times.
Really?
Because the first time they recorded it on some experimental Kodak film stock, they didn't know how to develop it, and it came out ruined.
Oh,
it was too dark. It was super green.
Like
in the beginning of the film. So,
okay. Yeah, because the beginning of the film had like more of a sepia kind of tone to it. It was very yellow.
Yeah.
And it definitely gave this like It had a tone to it. It had like a dirty, grungy, like, it wasn't leave this behind.
It wasn't supposed to look like that. Yeah. It's supposed to look like this, relatively nice and clean.
Huh.
So okay. I don't know if it's an artistic choice now to like have, like, they're in the zone and now it's like clean.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the intention going in because he had to re-record the film three times because the film during the development process kept on getting fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I kind of want to go back to the what we were talking about, the focus and how it's based on a work, because it relates to that. So Tarkovsky had, I think, a pretty solid vision of how he wanted this movie to be, much to some of the chagrin of the Soviets who bankrolled it. And, you know, compared to commercial thinking here, Tarkovsky was already really successful with Andrei Rublev and Solaris, two earlier movies he had made, so he could kind of make what he wanted. But he also thought his audience had more of a tolerance for his style, and so did the Soviets. But he deliberately wanted the movie to feel slow. So when he had to go before a board and they watched it and they're like, oh, damn, man, this movie feels kind of slow. And like, we have a problem with the pacing. And he responded to their problem with the pacing saying, I know, I wish the first part in black and white could be even slower to convey how things change. And they're kind of like, no, that's not what we meant. Like, you know, like you could maybe speed it up a little. But what I like to think about this movie that I think also applies to Solaris is that if you really know that material and you're thinking about how a person actually would experience going into a zone that's been afflicted with an otherworldly substance, or in Solaris, you are being afflicted by an otherworldly substance, a completely different form of life, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think Solaris also kind of is a relative to the movie Annihilation as well, in a different way, where it focuses more on the organism than on the environment. But I think in both cases, I want to believe Tarkovsky meditated on what it felt like for the character to actually immediately, imminently experience this world.
Mm-hmm.
And then only wanted to bring in elements of the plot as much as they added onto what it feels like to, you know, be in some vaguely militaristic, guarded shithole. And, you know, when I watch this movie, I think this is like clearly the Soviet Union, right? It looks so goddamn Soviet. But the book, I believe, was supposed to imply it was the United States. And that this was like a Superfund site that the U.S. just stopped caring about and sent the military to guard.
Uh-huh.
They also imply in Solaris that the characters are Western, which is interesting because, you know, the Soviet Union's very Eastern and it's very Eastern centric. And Tarkovsky brings an Eastern gaze of spirituality into his stuff.
Interesting. Because Tarkovsky saw 2001, A Space Odyssey, and was like, fuck this shit. It's too clean.
Yeah. And a lot of people say Solaris is a sister film to 2001 where, I've heard people say it has more heart than 2001 and that 2001 has more brain, but I feel like the heart and the brain of those two movies are just in different places with different intentions. And I think it would be misguided to say anything else. I haven't personally heard a case for saying Solaris or 2001 are better than one or the other without really siding with an intention of one movie or the other. They're made for different reasons.
Right.
And when Tarkovsky made Stalker, I feel like this is one of his more like perfect films in the fact that it is complete. It is internally consistent and it doesn't have like any side routes it goes down. It's not trying to cover bullet points of the book plot. It's kind of willing to be inventive and iconoclastic with the source material in a way that feels really bold for an artistic vision. Like you don't expect a director to just take the core idea and rebuild a whole different structure on top of it. But that's what happens here.
Here's the thing. Cause when you're saying when you're comparing 2001 to Solaris, they're made for different audiences. 2001 is obviously for the Western audience. And then Solaris is definitely for the Eastern audience.
Mm-hmm.
With Stalker, you know, this is clearly for the Russian or the Eastern Bloc countries. And yet I'm watching this and I know it's supposed to be like a fictitious country, trying to yeah. like harbor whatever energy
yeah.
that they don't understand. But it's clearly Russian.
Yeah.
It's clearly the Soviet Union. Hell, it even looks like Chernobyl.
Well, and that's the thing. He didn't really use any special effects and he didn't have any sets built. He went around areas that had gotten bombed out in World War II and never rebuilt, or like failed industrial projects, and just filmed there. Mm-hmm. And so this stuff that looks very artistically opinionated is actually very incidental. He found the beauty in these sites that we would think of as like Rust Belt core, right?
Right.
But like, but they look really beautiful. I mean, we're looking at a composition right now of when they take a break and they sit down, and just like the blocking of the two characters looking away from each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's a technique that, you know, Atlanta, a lot of the scenes borrow, where the characters are either looking away from the camera or looking away from each other
right.
to emphasize a disconnect with the world around them.
Sure.
There's a lot of this movie that I feel like is not particularly Eastern European, but it's more the feeling of getting caught up in a modern world that you don't have a grasp on. You're in the wasteland of it. You're on the fringes of it. And you're just trying to get to where you want, but you don't really know how the world's functioning around you. Like, how often have you felt like you're being guided by someone who knows all the dangers of a system you're trying to navigate, and you can't even see those dangers?
Right.
That's not a feeling that you would have as a peasant. That's not a feeling you would have as a hunter-gatherer. You know, that's a feeling of somebody who's in a society with a lot of bureaucracy, with a lot of institutions, mm-hmm. whether they're capitalist or communist, that just operate in a way that you can't discover how they function. You're not entitled to that information. And so I feel like the movie is more broadly just modernist than okay. it is Eastern or Western.
I think though that I think that kind of raises a question for me though, is that for what these characters are going for, you know, what they're searching for
yeah.
Between 2001 and Solaris and Stalker, do you think that is a reflection of the societies that they were built in? So if 2001 is from a Western perspective, what are those people going for? And if Stalker's from an Eastern perspective, what are they going for? And does that reflect the wants and needs of the people during those times?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So I like immediately I want to dive into that question. I feel like 2001 is an ultimately optimistic film uh-huh. about development in science.
Robot that kills everybody.
Right. I mean, the beginning of the movie, they're constantly reminding us how much of a miracle it is that any technology exists. And when, you know, the gorilla picks up the bone and all that stuff, to me, that's almost like there's a quote from Ursula K. Le Guin where they asked her, well, how do you write technology? And she goes, well, fire is technology, you know? And 2001 to me is trying to cast the broadest net possible of describing what technology is as a story. That the very beginning, technology is discovering a new way to use a object in nature as not prescribed. Like, a bone is not thought of as a weapon, but here the person uses it. They're not using their own body to fight. They're now using part of nature. Mm-hmm. And suddenly their destiny is changed by their use of an object. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of 2001, there's this AI that is existing totally within its own conditions. Mm-hmm. Importantly, the AI is not in nature. It's not on the ground. It's in a self-contained, you know, human-built like object in space.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing to me is that there's this like whole, you know, monolith throughout the movie that isn't human built, and it looks like the late technology, but it isn't. It just gets recontextualized every time people get more technology around it. So I think 2001 is a human second, technology first story.
Okay.
And, you know, and people say, oh, it's cold or it's not very personal or whatever. I would say that if you're not willing to emotionally invest in technology, you're not going to find it a very emotional movie. Whereas Solaris is a whole different angle to it. Solaris sort of.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Takes the technology for granted and wants to tell a story about life meeting life, and that that one form of life has no technology around it. Mm-hmm. It's just this ocean. It's, what is it, an algae bloom on an ocean that's projecting X-rays, and it's essentially reading the people's mind based on their brain waves and materializing this stuff in a way that seems technologically advanced, but it's not. And then you have these scientists who, they can't make sense of this with all of their technology that they have, and it instead is hitting a very emotional, raw, non-technological core to themselves, and they can't make sense of it. And they're not willing to approach it on very organic terms where you're just sort of experiencing it phenomenologically. It's emergent, you know. So I feel like Solaris is not a movie about technology. It's a movie fundamentally about life, whereas 2001 is fundamentally a movie about technology, and like all objects that focus on it are technological. So in terms of, let's go back, I know I went off a little on a tangent. Let's go back to the Western versus Eastern question. I think the United States had a very strong optimism for technology. And I think this was based on an anxiety that the Soviet Union sort of baked in during the Cold War. We forget that the Soviet Union largely won most of the space race. They had the first satellite in space.
Sputnik.
First animal in space. Dog. First human in space.
A dude.
Yeah. First space station. Mm-hmm. And we were like, well, we made it to the moon, so we won. And it's like, I don't know if you get to like just pick one thing, you know,
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
But when
sick. You picked one giant ball of dirt out of millions.
Yeah. But there's a scene in October Sky that alludes to this where the Americans see Sputnik going by and they're kind of just like, fuck, like we thought we were doing so well with the atomic bomb, and there's this whole other area of science that we're not prepared to know how to do. And I think it gave America for like half a century this baked in anxiety for like getting good at STEM, getting good at critical thought and comprehension. Mm-hmm. And sort of almost in I don't want to say propaganda, because I don't think it was like the elites projecting downwards, but just a tendency in America to say, wow, look at all this stuff. We have, you know, we have DuPont chemicals, we have nuclear power, we have this and that. In 2001, to me, was made by Kubrick, who was in the silent generation. He wasn't the hippie generation. He wasn't a baby boomer. He wasn't skeptic of technology wrapping all around us. And that's really what it reflects. It reflects sort of problems that arise within technology. But in the back of your head, watching 2001, it's kind of like, isn't this so cool that we're dealing with these problems and not getting hit with a bone or a rock? Like, mm-hmm. Hey, didn't we upgrade in problems? Mm-hmm. Whereas like when you watch Solaris, it's sort of like, I don't know, like, congrats, you made a space station. Congrats, you made all this cool stuff. There's still no way you're going to even be able to communicate with this thing in a way that makes your empiricism meaningful, in a way that makes your rational model applicable. It's just not there.
I felt this. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you could feel the same way about HAL, right? In the sense like, even though we created this thing, we have no hold of it. It's just learning on its own.
Yeah.
And it's just honestly outshining us.
Sounds familiar.
Well, and so I think if you had that question of how to make sense of a life form, mm-hmm. in 2001, as crazy as the AI gets, they can still talk to it. Right. And only in like the last scene, hope anyone listening hasn't like not watched 2001, because like pause it and spend 3.5 freaking hours watching
it. Spoilers for a 50-year-old movie.
Yeah.
Go.
Yeah. But the final scene where he's like singing Daisy and all that stuff is basically like, oh, now you're outside your comprehension, but there's still a chance to make sense of it. And like life starts again and there's a baby and whatever. The with Solaris is sort of like, I think it's a very Marxist idea of science, which is sort of like, it doesn't matter how much somebody knows. What matters is, can you explain that? Can it advance everybody? Can everybody comprehend it? Mm-hmm. And it's sort of the Marxist anxiety of like science becoming what they call quote unquote bourgeois, or like in an ivory tower and inapplicable to improving everyday life, you know? And I don't think Tarkovsky's particularly Marxist, even though, like we're talking about, he's born in a Marxist world.
Mm-hmm.
But he definitely, he takes that as an assumption of, like, science is useless if it doesn't have this everyday application. Science is useless if it doesn't move things and change things. And I think as the Soviet Union ended up collapsing, it was under kind of a Marxist critique of, like, well, how's our everyday life getting better? Sure, we have a bunch of nukes, but the grocery stores suck. Going to work sucks. You see this when they interviewed people during like Glasnost and all this. Mm-hmm. They're asking like, what is actually getting better? Like, what is actually comprehensible? What is, you know, being fixed? And it's pessimistic. And and so this, Solaris and Stalker were made at the height of Soviet power before the stagnation had really kind of taken hold. And the reason I'm saying this is because pessimism really hadn't gripped the country the way it would in the 80s. And so it's not optimistic. It's not pessimistic. It's a society that's one of the two at the top of its game, asking the really deep question of like, even if you can discover this thing and even if you can make use of it, what has it actually done for your life in a way that you like just experience reflexively, spiritually, instinctively? Like, how has it actually shifted that?
You know, that's so mind blowing because like I bring up, you know, he's walking through the wasteland of essentially failed projects of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
So you would assume that this is a commentary on the decline of the empire of the USSR. And you're saying that it's not, and he's not making a political statement through science fiction, but he is just making a story during the context of the height of the USSR.
Yeah, because I think that the USSR, and this is sort of in like the way that I think a lot of the more brutal leaders of the USSR justified it, that like waste is inevitable, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is also sort of the left before the rise of the green movement and how we internalize that in our aesthetic of what is good and what is bad. I watched a 1930s American film where they say smoke breeds progress, where like seeing a bunch of belching smokestacks is a sign you're going to be okay. That is not the way that modern people look at smokestacks and industrial waste. You don't think like, God, I'm at the middle of the engine of the world.
We're working.
Right, America. Right. And so America was also very much in that, and fascist societies like Nazism were very much into that aesthetic, and even, you know, monarchist colonial ones. But communism didn't really let go of that. There was no big event that sort of morally indicted it the way that, like, you know, it eventually came in the form of Chernobyl, like very late, but there wasn't really a, oh, look at these rich people shitting up our ground. The aesthetic in communism was like, well, we're all shitting it up together to get somewhere. Mm-hmm. So for that reason, I don't think that this is really a critique of it. And conversely, I think Tarkovsky is actually kind of trying to show you how what is left behind can be beautiful. And, you know, Zizek has a quote where he said, like, sometimes to be in the presence of the past, he says, like, the only thing to do is meditate on it. And he's in an abandoned airplane in, like, a garbage dump sitting in it. And
I saw that clip.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
It's like one sentence that's so poignant. And then he starts talking about nonsense right after.
Yeah. And I mean, he's following a very specific Hegelian rational model that some of it is worthless, so it's not worth understanding, but he doesn't really become clear with a lot of things he says until he gives you an everyday example. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, okay, don't give me this whole thing of like Lacan and the thesis and the antithesis and where your heart is and all that. Like, just give me an example. And that quote, I just think of when I watch Stalker the whole time, is like, all these people had to do here other than be in fear of what the danger is to just sort of meditate on what a world without humanity, but very much still full of life, looks, where humanity's just a scar or an artifact and something remembered.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about Chernobyl because, okay. Like, before I just went into this blind.
Yeah.
And I thought this was a commentary of Chernobyl, but mm-hmm. Chernobyl wouldn't occur until 7 years after
yeah.
this movie. I say 7 years because that's a specific number important to this film because, you know, we talked about it earlier. He went to industrial wastelands and failed projects that was polluted land from industrial waste. And guess what? Most of the crew, including the lead actor, the wife of Tarkovsky and Tarkovsky himself all died 7 years after creating this film.
Really?
And Chernobyl happened right before he died, yeah. like a few months before he died.
Oh, wow. Okay. So
I just wonder if he had, say he never made Stalker, he never went to all of these cancer-ridden places, say he were to live, he would be still alive today. He'd be in his 80s. Mm-hmm. Say he witnessed the Chernobyl disaster and was like mind blowing, like that waked him up, like, oh my God.
Oh, that would have, I feel like the movie he would have made in reaction to it would have been very, very powerful. And so he had died and all these people had died of cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was even more than those three. I think it was like 7 or 8 people. It was almost like and there's a scene coming up here where about halfway, 2/3 of the way through the movie, where they're going to wander through this murky looking waste, like up to their waist. And they actually did that. Like,
yeah.
You know, they like that's actually wild. Wandered through. And I don't think it was nuclear waste. I think it was biological waste and chemical waste. But still very like shocking yeah. to.
They're wading through petroleum.
Okay.
Which yeah. is not good for humans.
Yeah. It was, yeah. I guess that was another question I had too, is that when I think of like an industrial wasteland, like we're talking about just leftover like pollutants that mm-hmm. you have no business being near. Like,
yeah, I mean, this was kind of before we had a lot of those standards, you know, and it was like there was not really an environmental movement to speak of in the Soviet Union. It existed in a very remote, occasional, inconsistent way within intellectuals. But the Soviet Union sort of either very practically baked in a reform or didn't, but they didn't really trigger a bigger discussion about, you know, what is okay for the environment, what isn't. Part of it was that they regarded it as bourgeois, like they were like, this is rich people, middle class people wanting sort of a garden mm-hmm. when not everyone's housed, and it's hypocritical, and the, you know, the primacy of focusing on what the working class needs. But yeah, it just really wasn't there. Mm-hmm. So I think if you watch this movie, I think, A, it's totally acceptable to watch it through the gaze of somebody raised in the environmental movement. It adds a new layer to it, like Armand was saying. It adds a whole lot to the movie. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't part of the gaze of this movie. It was just more what sort of desolation looks like. What loneliness looks like, mm-hmm. yeah. you know,
it recontextualizes the film because like, yeah, like you said, Mike, when this came out, this was a meditation piece on isolation and loneliness and being alone. And yet when we watch it now with our modern lens, knowing that most of the crew died.
Yeah, that too.
mm-hmm. It's like,
and knowing Chernobyl happened.
Yeah. And Chernobyl. And it's like, there's a scene where in addition to them wading through like toxic sludge, there's a scene where the ground looks like it's like moving.
It's breathing.
Yeah, yeah. And like a whole bunch of like looks like pollen in the air. That's not pollen. That's pollutants.
Yeah.
And a lot
it's
of
not
people,
even a special effect.
Oh.
So
oh,
everyone God. That was at that scene shooting died. And like the people that were like filming it got like initial like rashes on their face.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
So, is this again like the 7-year waiting period and then they died? Or
some of them got that way immediately, but But I think what's amazing to me about that, and it ties into like what this shot is here that we're seeing, is that there's almost no special effects or set up. It's very much just filmed with a camera waiting for the right moment to hit in the right location and just kind of capturing the beauty of that. And
it reminds me of digital versus film for some reason.
That's another layer of gaze where I think that as you become aware of how much film can be manipulated, there's a relationship to the technology where you become a little bit cynical in the face of beauty because you're like, well, that isn't effort. That's easily constructed. And then when you see earlier work that couldn't very easily construct it, you don't give a lot of respect to it. And I feel this when I watch like older, like practical effects where like something takes me out. If people watching that at the time might have clearly known it was a special effect, but would have been filled with a sense of wonder that, you know, there's an effort and a mystery to it, and you can't immediately attribute it to CGI or something.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see like all of the wind blowing, there's a shot, I don't think it's in Stalker, I think it's in The Mirror, where just the whole field blows like a wave in a specific way.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone who's like watched too many Marvel films is just kind of like, I know I was kind of like, and then I was like, oh, they actually had to like be there for that moment and to capture that moment.
Capturing the moment.
Oh, there's
just like a photographer.
Yeah.
Which is what he is at heart.
I do love this typography. Man,
yeah.
It's perfect.
Very 70s typography.
Yeah, yeah.
Brutalist.
Yeah.
From the Soviet Union.
Yeah, but I mean, also I think Tarkovsky, for a Westerner watching it, going back to Eastern versus Western, it's really easy to look at Russia and be like, this is like a bleak, kind of like inaccessible crap hole, because I think climatologically, but well, having to do with weather, our idea of beauty is very much like what
I thought for some reason, meteorology, isn't that?
Yeah, it could be Well, what I'm getting at is we sort of see the most beautiful things, in my opinion. I think the standard of beauty, like when we talk about the standard of beauty with people, people talk about whiteness or wealth or proximity to it. For landscapes, I feel like the bias that we have is summer, things that resemble the summer, maybe the tropics. And Russia does not have a lot of things resembling a sunny day or the tropics. It's a very cloudy country. There's a lot more cloud cover for the weather. And there's a lot of painful history. And there's an aesthetic left over from very painful history, like the Nazis leveling everything or the Soviet Union just kind of building things in a quick schlocky job like Khrushchev and Ayaz and all that.
Napoleon.
Yeah, yeah. And so they're like, if you look at the photos of Smolensk from before the world wars, there's this early color photography took these beautiful photos, and it looks like some magical place partway between the east and the west. And it is the weather of Nebraska, but it's filled with these wooden forts and castles painted green and white and blue and red. And it was all leveled. It was like the Nazis burned the whole place down. It like suffered in the wars. And then when the Soviets rebuilt it, they were like, well, the priority is that everybody gets like a house with an apartment with a kitchen. And we're just going to do prefab concrete because everyone's homeless. Let's just do that, right? And you get functionally wise that way, but it becomes a much harder place to love when everything is just sort of this concrete
brutalist.
It reflects an ideal of efficiency, and the most inefficient parts of architecture are what are the most beautiful. And by extension, like this murkiness and this muddiness, you know, we don't think of a healthy world as one with a lot of cloud cover. We don't think of a pretty world is just a kind of like a prairie grassland, like a lot of Russia is. It looks like a really boring area of the Midwest that you would pay a lot of money to leave and go on vacation from or something.
And
Tarkovsky's really trying to make it beautiful. I mean, he's really asking you to sit there and stare and go like, aren't you glad I chose this place? Aren't you glad I chose this like temperate Köppen climate DFA fucking area, you know, to film this? And you're just kind of like, yeah, I guess. I mean, it's like you don't think it's beautiful. It's the way that, like, you know, we were talking about Dune. Denis Villeneuve has that shot with a Harkonnen coming out of all the like oil jacuzzi or whatever it is. I don't know, but you're like, damn, that nasty oil looks really nice, you know. Suddenly he shows you the beauty in it. And that's what this movie is doing over and over. It's basically like asking you, like, well, are you paying enough attention to find it beautiful? Or did you like stop holding it in your hand and drop it? You know,
I'm not going to sit here and say Tarkovsky doesn't have an eye. He has an eye. Almost every single composition in this film is so perfectly executed. It's well framed and well shot.
Yeah.
And I don't like it's to say that he's nothing less than a visionary, an auteur, is not giving him justice. Like,
yeah.
He is
an auteur.
You know, a visionary.
I've never
heard an artist.
Yeah, auteur is sort of like you do all of it. So like Wes Anderson's an auteur. He wants his visuals and his sound and his character's behavior to all work
Kubrick.
In sync.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would even go as far as to say Michael Bay. Is an auteur. No, I'm just kidding.
He's like an auteur of the consensus, I would say. I mean, his movies are aesthetically consistent, maybe.
I triggered Mike.
Ew, look how, like, just sudsy.
Yeah.
That's all pollutants, my friend. That's what killed Tarkovsky.
How old was he when he died?
Not that old.
53
yeah,
53 or something.
Damn, really?
54.
He would still be alive today.
This was also the last movie he filmed in Russia. He then made a movie, I believe, in Italy and in Sweden.
And he was like, fuck the USSR, I'm not going back.
No, I mean, he actually, the story behind that is he said, like, I have nothing against it. I think they were fudging the system to not let him back in. Like, they didn't give him an entrance visa or something goofy. And he very much clarified in interviews, like, yeah, I'm not like a big Marxist or communist, but I don't think it's bad that it runs the country. Mm-hmm. You know, he was just sort of like the equivalent of an American who might have some gripes or whatever, or might like visiting another country, but they don't really feel like there's anything wrong with liberal democracy or the system here. And he sort of had that same attitude. I don't know if it held him back, because I know he did walk a line with his art. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he could have been even crazier if he had been in a more capitalist society. Or maybe conversely, he would have fallen into being like Michael Bay and never would have gotten a chance to do that.
Honestly, I think he would be like Orson Welles, to be really honest.
That.
Because like looking at him, because this was during the same time as Orson Welles.
Yeah.
And oh my God. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing because, like, he was like, you know, I'm going to do, you know, I have the image in my brain. I'm going to try my best to transpose it onto film.
Yeah.
And that's what Orson Welles did too.
Yeah.
But the studio held him back. And guess what? Same fucking thing with Tarkovsky. They're like, hey, man, the pacing is a little off. Fuck, I knew it was too fast.
Yeah, no, and Orson Welles also, when he made Citizen Kane, he had sort of this statement where they're like, how'd you do all these shots? And, you know, he came from theater and he was like, simply because I didn't know that you couldn't do that. And I had a cinematographer, you know, a director of photography, where I was like, can we go through a window down a hole over here? And the guy was like, sure, let's try it. Come on, Orson.
Let's do it. We're going, man.
Yeah. So with Tarkovsky, I think the difference is Tarkovsky's like, it must have this element and he'll fudge with it. But I think a big element that Tarkovsky has is sort of this wabi-sabi adopted by somebody who is not Japanese, the same way that like Frank Lloyd Wright does, where he wants to exalt, he wants to let a creation exalt the incidental, right? Like the same way that Falling Water does, or the same way that, like, you know, the Zen rock beds in Japan do, where you want decay that is incidental to elegantly reflect time. And you know, people talk about in design how something that is honestly designed with its materials, as it decays, it will be elegant because it'll actually reflect the way that what it looks like behaves, right? You're not using plastic that looks like wood or plastic that looks like metal. You're actually using steel. You're actually using wood. And as it ages, it'll get a patina, or it'll, you know, it'll absorb oils from being handled in the wood. And when you look at things that are built with their own honest materials, we can contrast the Soviet Union, where it was prefab concrete that they tried to make look like something else or just look like that. You look at like Venice, for example. Venice is falling apart. It literally floods all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just like it floods with sewage all the time.
Yeah.
And yet the way that it elegantly decays, like, captures the imagination across cultures, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and so I feel like that's sort of another, I'll lump that into the wabi-sabi thing I'm talking about. He's just filming a fire here. Look at this scene. It's a fire, and you're like, wow, what a gorgeous fire. And the cynic in me that's watched too many movies of the 2010s is like, you CGI the fire exactly how you want, big freaking deal, whatever. But like the direction all these characters are looking with the fire, wow. Like,
I'm going to admit something here.
Yeah.
I can relate with Tarkovsky because I don't know about you guys. Mm-hmm, there's these great channels on social media. On Instagram, it's Decaying Midwest, where this guy goes urban spelunking into abandoned malls, abandoned buildings all throughout the Midwest.
What's it called? Urban Decay?
Decaying Midwest.
Decaying
on Midwest. Instagram.
And Urban then Decay, I think, is a makeup brand.
That is a makeup brand. Someone's going to Sephora.
Anyway, got to make it fierce.
Well, I mean, Urban Decay is like a legit term, too. I mean, like, that's probably the most dramatic imagery when you think of Urban Decay is like the Bronx in the 70s.
And, yes. Outside of Chicago. And then on YouTube, there's Bright Sun Films. He has an abandoned series where he goes into abandoned locations and talks about them. And there's a certain beauty with something that's, one, abandoned. So it's kind of like that liminal space, back rooms vibe. And then decaying, like you said, where it's like in the elements. And then it's like, you know, you extract the human care to it. Mm-hmm. And then it's just left to the environment. And it's like, how would that interact with the world? Where would vegetation come into play? How long would the building last to its elements?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence when we talk about a lot of this that urban decay and just decay in general, industrial decay, became a thing that came to a head in the 70s and 80s because it was kind of the end of the, I think, like the era and the perspective of development that began with the Great Depression, or at least after World War II, where it was just sort of like build. And you're sort of just thinking of things that when they're done, they're eternally done. Or at some point you'll recognize it needs to be done again and not think about it. And what came after that era in both communism and capitalism was more of an idea of how to meditate on how it affects people and nature. Like, well, if we're building all of this, are we ruining lives while we do it? And this is like the shift that the Catholic Church makes under Pope John Paul II. It's a shift that the left makes in the 80s about environmentalism. It's a shift that the right makes in the 90s, where they're talking about communities and all of this and not just how big you can make it, you know?
Right.
And there, and I think there was a question raised of like, essentially, now that we're building, how do we recognize the metabolism of our construction? How do we recognize the like moral and ethical effects of our construction? And how do we learn to love it again? Mm-hmm. Because the signs of construction and the signs of development have now become associated with evil. Like, you look at this, we're talking about the effects of Chernobyl. We look at this in this world, despite how beautiful it might be filmed, looks almost like our idea of hell. Like, it looks like where your dreams cannot come true. And that's maybe the attractive, like, what do you call it?
Well, it's the difference. Contrast. Yeah, it's the difference between, because like what you're describing with America is the excess.
Yeah.
Like, we built all of these infrastructure and then now we're not taking care of it. And now it's decaying and falling apart.
Yeah.
And with Chernobyl, it's the mishandling of an energy we don't yet understand. Because nuclear energy is, oh my God, it's amazing. It could power the entire country with like just a few plants. And there's barely any other than radiation and plutonium and all that. But there's barely any pollutants that go into our atmosphere. But if it's not handled correctly, as we've seen with Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, Fukushima, it can have disastrous consequences for the environment.
Well, I think Chernobyl isn't as much that they didn't understand it as in, but like there were plenty of people in the Soviet Union who knew how nuclear power worked, just like in the US. But if you look at how Chernobyl was caused, it was essentially a bunch of amateurs, new hires, you know, NEPO hires, who were tasked to run a safety test that deliberately overrode very good safety measures designed into the system.
Right.
And so it kind of, to me, what Chernobyl showed was like, a failure to educate, B, that good design is not completely resistant to hazard, that like you can find somebody who knows just enough to subvert the safety design, but not enough to be safe, which is like frightening. And then the other thing it showed us was that like you cannot put people at the helm of it who don't know what's going on. And I still don't think we've really understood or realized that in a lot of ways. We're still thinking of, like, you know, leadership, like management, is this amorphous, undefined ability, and that it's not specific to a field in a lot of ways. And, you know, career managers were a part of that equation that caused Chernobyl. There were thousands of people who were equipped in the Soviet Union to run Chernobyl that weren't running Chernobyl, or were not being listened to literally inside of Chernobyl when it happened. And so I think what all those questions cause us to meditate on is, A, like you said, access. Are the people who ought to get access to this thing getting access to it, either because they need it or because they're the most qualified or whatever? Mm-hmm. And then what are the people who inevitably have the access imposed upon them? They're affected by it, even though they don't want to participate. They don't want to be there. And, like, the ancillary effects of building these things that sort of get imposed on other people also get imposed on nature, get imposed on ecosystems. And so the question is, when we're talking about, like, well, what is wrong with all this construction? You're kind of asking where the construction fits into the world unintentionally, intentionally. Where does it fail to intentionally be found? And Stalker is kind of a movie where it's like this imposes itself on the world. And then these people, the government tries to build an interface of making it impenetrable. And these people try to build an interface in the form of going into it that is penetrable, that is understandable, you know? So yeah, but I think it's very nascent. It's in its early stages. That idea here, there's a little bit of it here, and it fits into a later development that we can retroactively look at with that more developed gaze.
Right.
But I don't want to give Tarkovsky that much credit for awareness. Like, I think in his search for infinity, he found something that aged well.
Hmm. Okay. Well, with that being said, let's get off the fence. If Tarkovsky didn't die 7 years later, after witnessing Chernobyl, would he have made a movie similar to Stalker, but more pointed and more politically pointed towards the USSR on the dangers of environmentalism and, you know, communism led to this disaster? Do you think he would have turned towards that? Because, like, I'm pretty surprised he's pretty agnostic towards communism or Westernism.
Well, I mean, you have to remember what it felt like to be a Soviet. When we hear about the great purges and Stalinism, you know, America developed without killing a bunch of people. And that makes it really great, where we talk about a good year of GDP growth in America, but industrial growth in America in the 1800s was, like, over the whole century was something like 1,000% or some ridiculously huge number, where we achieved scale in a way that not a lot of other countries could copy. And part of it was because, you know, the dream of a classical liberal economy is that there's this infinitely available land resource that doesn't become politically bogged down. And we achieved that through, like, you know, an illusion or a fallacy by killing or scaring away Native Americans, right? So we did have this very widely available land that couldn't be replicated. And communism under Stalin and fascism under Hitler wanted to clear people out in order to have that same industrial fresh start.
I see.
But they had to deal with a much more aware society that would not allow, I think, another thing like Manifest Destiny and the Native Americans happen. If you really think about Lebensraum under Hitler, or you think about the way Kazakhstan got developed under Stalin and he pushed all these minorities there, it's not really that different from Manifest Destiny here. We just didn't have our eye on who was getting screwed over. Mm. And so the Soviets experienced a society that was the most backward in Europe, that became the biggest economy with, like, some of the most electricity outside of England or France or Belgium or the Netherlands in a very short amount of time. And a lot of people died for it. And there's a question Americans have never had to ask, which is, like, how many lives would it take to end up with a really advanced society in a very short amount of time? And it's a question not only communist societies asked, but heavily developmental societies with a shitty human rights record asked, like South Korea. like Taiwan in the 70s, South Korea in the 70s. You know, the development under Saddam Hussein, people forget that Iraq under Saddam was one of the most advanced Asian societies at the time. And Saddam literally took in the middle of a party meeting, people outside and shot them for being traitors. We have it filmed. You know, the other people are crying. Why did they put up with this? Because their lives got better. And I sometimes wonder, like, if America didn't have this very particular project that combined our climate, our demography, all of this, how many Americans would just side with heartless, dehumanizing development or to pick this nuanced middle view? Because I don't think Tarkovsky, I don't think he embraces or indicts it. I think he does this thing in the middle where he instead asks the thing of, if you cannot affect it, if you're just caught up in it, what does that feel like spiritually?
It is what it is.
Yeah. And then what is it? Like without declaring that a bad thing requires change or a good thing requires embrace, what does it feel like to just meditate that things are that way? Right. And as a guy raised in the Great Purge and the World War II and everything that he was, I think that you that's the first thing you feel before you get an opinion or an idea of what should be done. Mm-hmm. You're in the middle of that, you just have that view, and in the mirror, he goes into that where he shows his mother during the Great Purge, nervous about screwing up work. And the other people are kind of joking about it. And other people are like, you know, feeling bad with her, and other people don't understand. And it's just the ecosystem of life in the Great Purge in a way that isn't apologizing for or indicting the Great Purge. It's just kind of like, hey, here we are, you know, like that sort of thing. So he's kind of doing that in Stalker. These people are not like, well, the military should leave, or this should be for everyone, or, oh, it's evil. They're just kind of like, I got to go. I got to do this. I got to be here. Those are the stakes. Here I go. And the first scene of the movie introduces the wife, who's like, fuck you, don't do this. It's bad. It's evil, and it's going to ruin our family.
Right.
And he's not even saying like, this is the best thing ever. I mean, later on, he says this is place of solace, but he's not even saying like, yeah, I agree, or no, I disagree, or it will make the world a better place, or it'll make our family better. He just goes, nah, I got to do it. Like, this is the world I'm in. This is the role I play. Here you go. You know,
Diego.
Yes. Could you ask the question again, please?
If Tarkovsky didn't die 7 years after making this movie, yes, do you think he would be essentially anti-communist?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Because of Chernobyl. Because Chernobyl happened 5 months, 6 months before he died.
Okay.
And then he died.
I can more directly answer that question in a sense.
You're saying no.
I think that Tarkovsky would have, because of that thing I said about the Great Purge, I think he would have depicted glasnost in a similar way of what it feels like to be caught up in a collapsing system where people are starting to talk about it, but still just trying to have an everyday life. And I think he would have done the same thing during like the wild early, you know, Washington Consensus of Russia in the early 90s. Depicted that and meditated on that too.
Is he more like Franz Kafka in a way, where he's just he is aware of the tyranny through bureaucracy, but he's just
Kafka,
part of
Kafka focused on that. Kafka's eye was on terror Tarkovsky's is on Solace. Like, I feel like it's a whole different point of focus.
Okay.
You know, they're living in similar worlds, right? Kafka's living in Czechoslovakia, Austria-Hungary, mm-hmm. Central Eastern European. You know, he's Jewish. He's in a Slavic area dominated by Germans, and it's developing very fast, and it's bewildering. But, you know, the guy gets turned into a bug, and he doesn't think like, huh, I'm a bug now. Isn't life beautiful? He goes, fuck, I'm a bug, and I have to get to work. And my family hates me, like all of this shit. Mm-hmm. Like, where's the panic in a Tarkovsky film?
There isn't.
Or if there is, it's so obscure and transcendental and removed from the imminent danger or the imminent safety. You're kind of just like, why is someone calm or why is someone panicking?
You know, okay. Here's a good example. This is for you, Diego.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Franz Kafka is like punk rock.
Sure.
And Tarkovsky is like emo.
Okay.
Because like when I was looking at all his movies, there's a certain sense of solemnness to all of his movies. Yeah. There's no anger. There's no like, oh, we need to like this. Isn't the system so bad? He's like, the system's bad and I'm depressed about it. There's nothing I could do about it.
Right. Yeah.
This is the world I know. Isn't the world like, there's darkness, but there's beauty in darkness. So I guess he's goth in that way.
I mean, honestly, though, when I'm like, when I think about soccer and when I'm just like, you know, from what I've seen so far, it's definitely a bleak world, right? Like, it's, I mean, nature is being tainted on the sense of like of us just intruding onto the environment. It's not a good look. So yeah. Now we have this mysterious energy from another world that's literally kind of intruding on our minds. So in a sense of how we intrude, you know, onto nature, it's kind of in the same way. I think definitely if he were to witness or kind of find out about Chernobyl, I definitely see how that could be an inspiration for something he would do next. I think that his goal and just the interesting part of picking a person of science and a person of the arts to go into this inner domain is, you know, it's just represents two sides of how, you know, of how our brains work, right? You kind of think of the left and right brain, and no matter what, these people are in it for themselves. You know, they're in it to advance themselves. They're in it to do whatever it takes to, you know, they're willing to go through these traps and to just kind of ignore the signs, if you will.
Yeah.
And I definitely feel like that, I don't know, Tarkovsky's trying to convey that. He's trying to convey what, you know, he's conveying how much more intrusive can we possibly be. So I think if he were to kind of adapt a new film inspired by Chernobyl, it would almost be, yeah, like I think maybe the next step would be like a more physical representation of like a quote alien, when this is more of an energy representation. I mean, I know we talked about how Solaris kind of does that, but Solaris is we're taking ourselves to an alien planet. I feel like the next deep dive would be, you know, actual visitation, because then that it would even just how this movie kind of test time till today. That concept would have tested time, if not even more, to today, right? And I guess I don't know. I definitely think it would be interesting. I do really like this kind of I don't know, this deep dive. It's like the stalker person, right? The main character. I mean, it's kind of funny because, okay, but what is the thing that he wants to get out of this, you know, by visiting these ruins? And it's like he's living out his desires of showing people, look what I found, right? It's like, like I am a good for nothing person. I'm poor. I don't have anything, but my life is to enlighten people onto, you know, what it is that I've found.
It's interesting too that he says early in the movie, and I know we have it like on mute, so you probably didn't catch it, but he says he's never actually gone into the room himself.
Oh wow.
So and they have a part where I think they also had this pass through where there's another stalker he keeps talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy has a brother who died. And he was like really sad that his brother died. And so he's going into the room ostensibly to have his brother come back. And he walks into the room. And instead of his brother coming back, he gets like $10 million. Because he actually deep down wanted that more than his brother coming back.
I think as much as he would have liked to have his brother coming back, he's like, how can this room ever bring him back? Because what if you want your brother back, you want to be with your brother? Because he walked in the room and just killed him. Boom, you are now with him again, you know? So
the monkey's paw.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I don't necessarily think that is a I think the fact that the guy got the money isn't necessarily a negative, like, oh, he's just actually greedy. Like, no, I think he's just trying to move on. And if you have, I mean, shit, if I had $10 million, I'm not even going to say that. I'm going to say if the person had received $10 million because that's what is going to help them to move on, then I think that makes sense. I think that, like, you know, he's trying to be real. I think he's like, I think it shows that whoever wanted that money is skeptical of, does this actually work? But also being realistic of, there's no way my brother's going to just reanimate in front of my eyes. Right.
Well, I think it wasn't as much. I think, you know, I think part of it is that they assume that he can come back, but that he actually really just wanted to be rich more than he wanted his family back, you know, and that they use it as sort of a cautionary tale of saying, well, you two want these things, but maybe that's just what you say you want, because that's a mix of the way you want to portray yourself, the way that you, the kind of person that you want to become.
Right. I'm not shallow. I want my brother back, but in actuality, I want to be rich.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that people act like being rich is a shallow deal. I think it came from a time where it was a lot easier to dig a ditch and buy a house and retire on digging a ditch, you know, in America, where it's like, well, you're making like 40 an hour. Like, why do you want more? But now, especially the generation we're in, it is possible to just like be stuck in retail or have an incredibly difficult career that to even get started or to just keep going. Whereas a very recent time ago, the big difficulty was starting your own business. And now it's almost just as difficult to have a job and find a job. HR departments are completely gone, you know, or often very close to gone. And it's not very clear in this era how to have a successful life. And to want riches over something like family, the family feels like the luxury and the riches feel like the more pragmatic thing. I mean,
right.
That might be like the quote unquote, like, you know, millennial gaze or whatever versus an older one, but we don't know how to survive without money. I mean, that sounds like a really ridiculous bland statement, but you know, only a couple generations ago, people knew how to, they got land and they were good, right? They knew, they were like, okay, I got some chickens. I can raise some stuff. I have to scare the animals away and like watch it. And it wasn't a complicated life. And to enjoy an average standard of living requires you to become training to become a very particular person, navigate that system in a way that is novel and new based on new technology and very difficult. And so to say, hey, I don't have to participate in that anymore. Oh my God. Great. Like, is your brother going to help you do that? Like, everybody loves their brothers, but you know, like, all I talk about with my brother and I is like often how difficult it is to just navigate this world. And he's a very educated guy, a very well-spoken guy. It's still a struggle. Like building off your point, Armand, I don't think that in building off of your point too, Diego, is like, yeah, the money doesn't seem that irrational or selfish to a person in a world that is difficult to just achieve a baseline idea of expectations.
But you also need money to survive, because like you're talking about, like, oh, back in the day, people just needed to dig a hole in the ground and that's my home. It's like, well, now the ground is being taxed. So even if you own property, you don't actually own it, because the government's like, where's my money? So you need money regardless.
I think it's too, I mean, like, obviously we live in a capitalistic society, so I think it's also hard to find value within yourself if you're not making money. I think it's hard to feel value when, I mean, if, when you're when we live in a society where you can like share videos and like provide a service for the sacrifice of, you know, creating content and just to like, you know, draw everybody in, it's then hard when you're like, wow, now I have to build myself up to that. Now I have to figure out what is this thing that is going to attract people to me. Essentially, you know, you're asking people to sell out. Like, I mean, maybe not so much sell out, that's kind of strong. But
on a bigger level, you have one conduit in one channel and one type of action in order to establish like value.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, it's limited socially where you can't go off and do something. I would also argue, though, that like, you know, the idea of land tax, farmers enjoy a really low land tax like everywhere. So mm-hmm. I don't think that's a particularly big issue.
They're also providing product that they could sell, which then creates money, which then helps out other people. So it makes sense that their industrial zone is not taxed as much as a residential zone.
I guess, but I question, I don't think we always need to get our food locally. And I don't want to like switch this into a whole economics argument, but you know, the current issue with water in California is because they're supporting a lot of farms that, while California takes pride in the fact that they have all these farms, they're in Mediterranean climates that have very arid summers that are better suited for very like arid food that doesn't make a lot of money. And they have a very mild climate that if you can get water into a lot of these areas. Mm-hmm. Now I know it's different in like the valley versus the south or whatever, right. But I think if you had a whole bunch of Californians making machines or programs on, and they would get a whole lot more, you'd be able to fit a whole lot more people that would be producing a whole lot more things. And all the land that people don't want to live on in like the Midwest or the South because it's too muggy or it's too cold and you have two good months or whatever, sure, have that be where all the food is made, you know, and have everybody live where they want to live, where it's easy for them to live and where it's easy to make sense of that. I guess what I'm getting at is I don't really accept that there's an easy thing like communism or capitalism that has caused this problem. I think it's the way that we've sort of constructed things to be more and more particular about the technology that already exists. And we're not willing to go back, completely erase it, and start in a different direction. If you think of feudalism and how people thought of power, they thought that having a lot of people following you mm-hmm. and having a lot of animals and a lot of livestock and a lot of plants, a lot of living things was the form of power. Ever since the development of America, but also the development of the Soviet Union, the focus on power was mechanical. And that seems obvious when you look at it in retrospect, like it had to become mechanical. But that's kind of a miracle that mechanical design and mechanical engineering augments an individual's power. And suddenly the idea of value and the value of power and the value of work changes. And I think now we're at the end point of getting utility out of mechanical power. And it's become more amorphous in the telecommunications era and all of this. And we've come into viewing, like you said, Diego, video and sharing art and sharing works is a big primary source of value. But we haven't really tied that back to like, how's it making food cheaper? How is it making homes easier? Like, where's my video that shows everybody how to build their own home very quickly, easily, and cheaply everywhere? And suddenly the problem of housing becomes arbitrary because we've pivoted the way that everybody handles technology. Well, we don't. We're still thinking like we have to operate in the old bounds.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if like, I think if mechanical power began with that assumption, like, well, you need a whole lot of cows before you can make use of a plow or something. Sure, you might have gotten like a little bit of development, but you wouldn't have gotten, you really wouldn't have gotten very far in a place like America where we were fundamentally limited mm-hmm. in the amount of people and the amount of livestock and the amount of available labor, right? Like that was a whole different type of problem. And so, like we were saying earlier, America was very particular. It wiped out the old population, but maybe the next big technological shift will be like on the moon or something, or on Mars, where there's a shortage of air too, right? Or there's a shortage of some other thing that we always thought was needed for power. Mm-hmm. Maybe where power or electricity or mechanical power cannot be reliable or can't exist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll go to Mars and find spice. Spice Malone.
Yeah, maybe it is spice. That's why it is red. You know,
hey, Arrakis.
It'd be pretty sick.
My dude.
Side note, guys, they just walked through the goopy puddle.
I saw that. I was like, ugh.
Look at this.
All right.
What the fuck is that?
This is the breathing.
That's how they all died. My next question.
I thought that was a frog, by the way. It's the rag being thrown.
I saw that earlier. It looked like the same like style of shot, the way it bounced. I was like, is that a frog? Oh, yeah. So he's starting to. Okay, this is a trap.
Yeah. Where it's like replaying.
Mm-hmm. Oh, is that how the trap manifests? It replays? Like,
They show up in different ways. Certain ones are like a gravity anomaly, and that's why he's having them throw the bolts. To see where gravity stops having them fall normally.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Oh.
Two more questions. Okay. These are going to be easier questions. But okay. Diego was talking about it earlier.
Yeah.
So with my second question, Tarkovsky changed the plot device from crashed UFOs to kind of like an energy source, which then is portrayed as a room where your wishes come true. Why do you think he made that change from the source material that he drew inspiration from? And I mean, I would assume that it's kind of like a desire to leave the Soviet Union. But since we've been talking at length that he's not really, he doesn't have disdain towards his governments. He's not really anti-communist. He's just making a film about how beauty decay can be.
Yeah.
But why do you think he made that change from, UFOs to this place can grant your desires if he's not making a movie about leaving the Soviet Union?
Well, think back to in the video we watched right before this, right? The stories of old guy, he talks about how Tarkovsky thought that Solaris was a lesser work because he was so bound by the mechanistic continuity of like a science fiction world. And I think he really resented that as a storytelling device where, you know, like think guys about the difference between fantasy and science fiction. You can aesthetically say that one's about this and one's about that. But to me, really what fantasy does and why Stalker feels closer to a fantasy film for me than a science fiction film is because fantasy has the power to reveal the world, primarily pivot around the plot and the characters. You watch Lord of the Rings, and nothing, unless you go and you read the Silmarillion or whatever, and you get really detail-oriented, a lot of the stuff in Lord of the Rings harkens to a depth you don't find out about. But the idea of it's only revealed in the first place to explain why a community has not tried to rise above their problems, or why somebody is suffering under a tragedy, or why they've, like, why Gandalf, an incredibly powerful figure, has just sort of restricted himself to living on the fringes of society, and why the wizards have sort of each given up in their own way. Tom Bombadil and Saruman are in their little zone or whatever. And you can't approach it like a science fiction world and go, well, that's internally consistent with the rings and Morgoth and whatever the crap was. It's not really the way that J.R.R. Tolkien wrote the story. He essentially added each of these elements to reveal a new challenge of the character, a new plot, a new character, whatever, right? And that's what fantasy does. If fantasy stops and starts going into world building detail, that fantasy kind of sucks. It's weak. You're just kind of like, why is it doing that? Right. Even when you read Dune, which feels in a lot of ways more fantasy than science fiction, they're sort of revealing this whole aristocratic transplanetary society for the sake of telling you why Paul cannot just like go fuck you mom and dad and like leave out the back door or grab a space shuttle and leave, why the women are not demanding a more equal society. You know,
it's Game of Thrones in space,
right? But the way he conveys Game of Thrones in space is by revealing the way these people are trapped as you need to, and the way that they're all trapped is that they're systemically trapped. So the system is only revealed in the form of obstacles for the characters. And then the detail plays itself out in how that detail is either overcome or it duplicates across all the characters, right? Like the ring, The ring starts as Gandalf's problem, Bilbo's problem, becomes Frodo's problem. And then they're like, meet all these really powerful people that are elves and humans and dwarves. And they don't have an easy way to solve it. They don't, you know, Gimli's like, well, fuck it. Smash it with a axe. And you're like, geez, these guys have no solution. Now the ring is all these other characters' problems. And you don't really find out the chokehold the ring has on the dwarves and the elves. You kind of get mentioned it, but you don't really find it out till they convey this council and all of this. And I'm saying all of this to say that science fiction tries to sneak in world mechanics before they become relevant. It's very different from fantasy in that way, in that they'll say like, oh, by the way, there's this place where people go on a network and do this thing before they introduce it as a problem or an obstacle or a tool or anything. Whereas fantasy will be like, hey, Harry, by the way, people get wands with unicorn hair in them, and you're about to get one, but also your dad didn't like one, and suddenly it ties all the characters together in a new way. They didn't try to sneak at the beginning like, oh, you're not going shopping for a wand because you live under a cupboard with your aunt and uncle, and like that's what a science fiction movie would do. It would sneak in the mechanics before the mechanics become relevant. This movie wants to reveal the mechanics as they are an obstacle.
Right.
And so to me, it feels more like a fantasy film in that way. And it obfuscates their function in a way that kind of betrays the promise of science fiction, of revealing consistent things that function like how a rational person understands the world.
Right.
So
I wouldn't consider it science fiction either. If anything, to me, it's like a 3-hour Twilight Zone episode.
Yeah, right.
And Twilight Zone never gets bogged down by exposition with like technology or whatever society that they're in. It's whatever the situation these characters are placed in.
I think Twilight Zone I would put into a broader umbrella term of speculative fiction, because Twilight Zone has revealed elements that then they both were brought up at the beginning and then they were revealed in a different purpose at the end. Like the woman who gets the surgery on her face and everyone's ugly at the end and oh my God, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of plays with science fiction and fantasy mechanics, but you're right in that it's really not the focus. And if there is a sort of mechanic world explanation in Twilight Zone, it's usually one single element. It's not like, there were aliens, they left a trace on a zone, and now it has effects A, B, and C, and now this character is going to build their goal around those things you already knew before the character started building their goal, and all of that sort of thing. This is just these people caught up in this world that's being continuously revealed to them in the same way that like Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter are like, by the way, Balrog is here. You never knew Balrog crap existed until you got trapped in a cave. And like, what's the scariest thing that could be in a cave? This big thing you didn't even know could be in a cave.
A dragon with a fire whip.
Yeah.
Fly, you fool.
But, yeah. And like, there's not even another character in Lord of the Rings that's like another Balrog. They don't meet the army of Balrogs that all have unions and clubs and churches and their goofy Balrog society. And you only have those elements of the elves revealed in Lord of the Rings because they're relevant. You don't find out about the elves' like sex life or anything. The closest you get is like one of them loves a man and they don't like that and whatever, moving on, you know, like so for this movie, I think Tarkovsky wanted storytelling, he wanted time, he wanted pacing in the character to have primacy over the mechanics of anything. He wanted mechanics to be largely aesthetic. You can call it a weakness of his. Maybe that's fair. But because of that, any feature of a genre that requires something mechanical falls in the background, right? Like even his historical movies, like his autobiography, The Mirror, you can watch it as a historical film about the Soviet Union, but he really doesn't reveal the mechanics of Soviet life, even though it'd be really easy for him to do. He wouldn't need to do research. He wouldn't need to have a copy editor. He would just need to recall his life, but he deliberately puts it out of order and has it revealed like a fantasy or a dream or something like that.
You know, you made the comparison to Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, now I see it. And now you're making the comparison to Lord of the Rings, and now I see it. It's like, I didn't even think of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But like, you're absolutely right. These characters on a journey to a destination, just like Frodo and the Fellowship to Mount Doom, they're going to the room.
Yeah.
And just like a Twilight Zone episode, the setup. Oh, there's this place where all your wishes come true. Journey to the place. They get to the place at the end, and it's not what they expected at all.
Yeah.
I, as the viewer, them as the characters, it's like, oh, this is it?
It's, and this is like the room now, where there's a telephone waiting for them. And what do you find out here?
This is the room?
Yeah, or it's right outside of it, actually.
Huh.
They're like right outside the room about to go in. And so what is revealed? Well, the scientist was here to destroy it the whole time just because it can't be understood.
Oh, shit. What?
And what is... Yeah, and so what does that say about Tarkovsky where... I mean, this guy is here to destroy what is incomprehensible, which Tarkovsky finds revolting, right? Like, the incomprehensible is the sacred. That is where we, mm-hmm. you know, find solace, and that what is comprehensible, what is understandable, somebody who understands it better than you do is going to use it to lord over you and a power over you.
Mm-hmm.
And so the incomprehensible is fundamentally democratic too, I think, like when presented that way. So I think it's interesting that Tarkovsky sort of destroys the primacy of mechanics in a world, and then he has a character doing the opposite, destroying the absurdity of an absence of mechanics or wanting to, mm-hmm. you know, and then he's deliberating about it.
Mm-hmm.
But you kind of can see what Tarkovsky thinks the enemy of the world is. He doesn't think it's this like really gross post-industrial zone that can hurt people. He thinks it's the people that want to get rid of it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. mm-hmm. It's the human elements that's the true danger.
And what does the writer want? Like, what was it revealed?
Lev Kamenev. I think he was much more, and you can tell me because I've just read the summary. You started to read the book, but I thought he was more of a classical science fiction author, like pre-Dune, pre. Philip K. Dick,
We're talking about the writer in the movie, right?
The writer of the story who wrote the book.
Oh, I was talking about... Like,
he's talking about the character.
Oh, yeah, Tarkovsky wrote the script with someone else. They wrote it...
The character, the writer.
Oh, my God, okay.
I was like, oh,
the writer, he basically is looking for a magical pill that'll make him better. Mm. And he doesn't want to believe that creativity is an exploration, that confronting yourself is necessary, that there's some easy way out of it. And the answer is kind of like, actually, dude, like all you did was go into a weird, funky shithole and almost like lose an arm or whatever. But you still don't have an easy way out of your original problem before you adopted all these other problems by smuggling yourself into like a military zone.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
So like. You know, so I think the writer is kind of there to say, like, hey, the problem of creativity, whether you encounter an unknowable or knowable thing, is still going to be there either way.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
you're still going to have to figure yourself out what you want to do. And the creativity is not coming from somewhere else. It's coming from your ideas and you left alone with your ideas and what sort of development or discipline or meditation you have to change those ideas into something comprehensible for yourself and the people you think should hear them, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
Mike, would you recommend this movie?
I would recommend this movie under specific conditions. Like, I would recommend this movie the same way I'd recommend, like a slasher flick. You're not here to watch a slasher flick in a library, but this movie you would watch in a library, right? Like, I would not watch this movie with other people unless they're willing to be, I mean, this is ironic because we've been talking through this whole movie on mute, but I would watch this movie like the way that you are supposed to be quiet in church. It is a movie where its idea demands so much space.
It's a meditative piece.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Honestly, it should be in, like, experience alone.
Yeah.
I feel thoughts.
Like, I've watched this movie in silence with like one other guy who wanted to watch a movie after like a long day that was a think piece. So I have watched it with like all the way through with someone else, but I don't think, like, if you're expecting a movie to be a social activity, this will betray you in some way. Either you'll have to be quiet or you'll miss out on the movie.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, it won't be that fulfilling. Where there are some movies you can watch both alone and together, like It's a Wonderful Life or Into the Spider-Verse, where like there's a layer you can watch in solitude and get a big point out of it. And then there's like a layer that is like a social celebration. This movie is not a celebration except in like the interior of its ideas. It doesn't readily make itself available. It asks everyone to bend around.
And it's also in another language. And if you don't speak Russian, you have to be locked into the script and the subtitles.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the good thing is the shots are so long that you don't miss out on a lot. Although you do miss out on like just kind of staring at it. Right. And like,
mm-hmm. right.
Pontificate, you're like, fuck, now I gotta read the bottom. Ugh, like,
it's an aggressive film, as in its runtime is super long. It's like 3 hours, and also it's paced extremely slow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's the antithesis of the Hollywood philosophy of film, that you show a plot point three times, three different ways, that you make it so that you can miss a scene and still fill things in. This movie feels like he went back to the silent film era and picked a different like editing language, a different way to focus on movies that is just sort of like, oh, fuck. Like, either you can approach it, either you can take this movie with like, oh, I'm watching it as I am right now, or you can read up on it like you did and get more context. But yeah, I don't know. It's kind of the movie that you got to watch it more than once if you choose to watch it.
He's a photographer that became a director. He's like Ken Burns.
Yeah.
If Ken Burns was Soviet.
But he also thought of being a musician, and he also was raised by a poet. And you have to remember that, because he's kind of bringing poetry into, like, look at this, just the tree growing out of the corpse in the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And very Denis Villeneuve, that you can't see all of the body, but you can see the hand, and you can see the sign of life growing out of the sign of death.
It's very Alex Garland in Annihilation, with the fungus coming out of the person of the corpse. Remember? Remember? I know what that is. I wouldn't recommend this film. It's such an aggressive film.
Yeah.
And unless you're like a Criterion slut, like all of us, like all
which
of us.
I am, you know.
Like, I would say, like, check out Annihilation, and if they're like, "This is amazing," you want to see the film that probably inspired it. Check out Stalker.
Like, ask them why they think it's awesome, you know, and then based on like, oh, I like the think piece of it, like, oh, you should go the Stalker route.
Yeah, I would say maybe have somebody watch like Annihilation, 2001, Samsara, really get into
hell, even Enemy.
Yeah,
have you seen Enemy?
No.
Oh, well, guess what? We're going to watch soon.
Okay. Well, but my point is, like, you have to watch this like you're either like a hunter in a blind waiting for a duck, and you notice everything moving in your environment, or you have to watch it the way Mark Twain talks about a riverboat captain watching the river, where every wave means danger or a faster route or something.
Yeah.
Or you have to watch it like, you know, like 2001 or something, to meditate on dramatic shots, like you're in a museum looking at photographs.
Mm-hmm.
But it just you're right, it demands a lot of attention, where it's like,
really does,
oh fuck, man, like, mm-hmm. yeah, Jesus. Mm-hmm. Like, I had a friend I showed it to who was so angry at this movie at the end. He was like, I thought the bomb was actually gonna go off and then something would fucking happen, and mm-hmm. and then
like a fish starts like sucking on it in the underwater, and then there's like a and then it doesn't even take off. It's fucking Russian. Doesn't even take in a Chekhov's gun, which there's a pistol.
No, it's the putting opposite.
In the water. And I'm like, okay, well, obviously he's going to come back for it, maybe kill somebody. Nope, never brought up ever again. And I'm like, what the fuck's going on?
And it's like the anti-Chekhov's gun, you know? Like, here's a gun. Thought this was going to be relevant? No.
Nope.
Like, the only things that, well, but the Chekhov gun is kind of like the ideas, right? Where you're just kind of like, part of the joy of watching it is like certain things you're following become ironically postured by the end of the movie, where you're like,
but I don't want to say it, but a better filmmaker like Alfred Hitchcock, who did Psycho, did the same thing with like the woman stealing the money from her employer. And then she goes into the Bates Motel and gets killed. And then Hitchcock pans over to the money on the bed. And it's like the main driving force of this movie. Doesn't fucking matter. And he could have did that with the gun.
I would, okay, now that, not to get into like a Psycho episode, but I would argue that Psycho is a movie about plans that don't work out. And that is fundamentally what they meditate on with every character, that their plan does not work out, including the woman that you never see alive, who turned out to be dead the whole time. Her plan for her son didn't work out. Mm-hmm. But like, the woman wants to steal the money. Plan doesn't work out. Guy wants to hide the murder. Plan doesn't work out. Guy wants to investigate the murder. Plan doesn't work out. Like, finally, the only person whose plan works out at the end is the guy describing the case in like the last scene, who knows all of it. You don't even know this guy. You've never seen him before. You don't give a fuck about this guy.
We'll put a pin in that because I want to talk about this at length.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't recommend this film. Like, mm-hmm. it's not accessible at all. And like, going into it, I'm like, holy shit. Like,
but for
like
slow cinema.
Super slow. And I watch boring shit. And I love it. And I'm watching this. I'm like, oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
see,
this
is
intense. I mean, it's so beautiful. I can't deny that. Like I said, the cinematography, the direction, everything about it. It's like, this is art. I'm watching an art piece. I'm in the art institute looking at some beautiful impressionist painting. That's what I'm seeing with this film. But damn. 3 hours long.
Well, like I said,
6 minutes going, walking through a tunnel.
If you liked Slacker,
God
if
damn.
You like Wong Kar Wai,
mm-hmm.
if you like I forget the Thai director who does Cemetery of Splendor and Uncle Boon Me, but if you get into slow cinema and that's kind of your vibe, I would say watch it. If you're not into slow cinema, even if you're into big ideas, but you're not into slow cinema, I would agree. No,
I can't believe I'm saying this, but the Soviets were right. You could have chopped out an hour of this film,
mm-hmm.
and it would have been great.
But like,
that's just me.
Part of the idea is the time itself.
I understand.
So
I understand.
You have attention there, you know.
I understand, but I like a short film.
Or if you want a long film, like mm-hmm. we were talking about Lord of the Rings, you want like, God, all this stuff happened by the end of 3 hours.
There's pacing and dialogue and friendships. Mm-hmm. And it's about the journey there. And the journey here, this is like, God damn it. Like, we're trudging through this.
It's a rainy day movie.
And
for
that
sure.
is the whole fucking point of this movie. Tarkovsky wanted you to feel what it's like for these people to go into the zone. He wanted you to think like the characters.
Pollution bubbles just sitting?
Bubbling?
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
And that's how they died.
He says, relax, you're not ready. Like, he's just not ready.
You're not ready to watch this movie. That's all I'm saying. This movie is an experience. Like,
here's what I'll say. If somebody wants to try out Tarkovsky, I would say, if you're okay with slow cinema, but you don't know if you like his focus, watch The Mirror. If you're not sure if you're okay with slow cinema, watch Ivan's Childhood, which is much more like his early movie that still has some quicker pacing to
right.
it. Don't watch Stalker until you've watched like one or two Tarkovsky films, definitely, and have watched other slow cinema. Because slow cinema does have different expectations. It has... It's waiting for things to emerge in real time.
Yeah.
You know, I saw a clip about the editor for, I think it was 12 Years a Slave. And there's a shot of just a guy, a slave being like hanged on a tree. And it's upsetting. And it is, they just don't cut. They don't show different angles. They just let that play out.
But that's different.
But it's conceptually the same, which is, give an idea the dignity to play out in its time.
And it's contrasted with traditional cinematic language that we're lingering on this because I want you to feel the reality of this.
Well,
Tarkovsky is like, let me do that for the whole fucking movie.
Yeah,
let
but
me,
I mean,
let me just
like,
linger
like,
on everything.
You know,
linger on someone's back of their head for like 5 minutes, and I'm like, God damn it.
Okay, but like Requiem for a Dream is the opposite, and it sustains itself a whole movie. Very, very quick shots,
mm-hmm.
you know? And there are other movies that let the whole thing be dominated
but it's
by...
it's a movie about junkies. Doesn't that make sense thematically? That's like...
Yeah, and this is like people taking a hike through sludge. Doesn't it make sense that the movie's a hike through sludge?
That's why I said I understand. Honestly, maybe I was too ambitious when I was like, yeah, let's do Stalker. And I'm watching this. I'm like, should it Ivan's Childhood? Should it Solaris?
Mm-hmm.
Should I did The Mirror?
I mean, to me, Solaris is even slower, but way richer in its like world building.
Because it's in space.
Yeah, and like
looks
there's
like
cool
Alien
scenes. Like, yeah, to me, I recently watched a movie. Was it called Aniara or Aniara? It's a Swedish movie about a space shuttle. Like, it's knocked off course, has no fuel, and just wanders through space for like years. And the movie's about like everybody full of despair. And HBO Max is like, oh, you watch Stalker, you should watch this. And I was like, well, maybe fucking more is gonna happen. And it's even more despair than this movie, because these guys, I mean, sorry, Diego, spoilers, they go back home. Like,
no, you know, I mean, I would explain.
They go back home, but they're forever changed, just like the Hobbits in Lord of the Rings.
Right, whereas this movie I watch, and spoilers for anyone who hasn't seen Aniara yet, is that, like, they just never get back on course. They're like, we need to boomerang around a planet or a moon. They never get close enough for one day to happen. This woman has a family. Her partner feels despair. Spoilers. Kills their kid and herself and is like, we're stuck on this fucking spaceship. Everyone starts to get like anemic from eating algae and goes blind. And then they just show her like floating jawbone 1,000 years later, and the space shuttle encounters a planet and everyone's dead. And you're like, oh, you bastard.
You know how I would have ended that movie. So she kills the crew, her kids. And then right as she looks out the porthole, right in the distance, International Space Station. Ah, no.
Well, that's the whole thing.
That's how
is
it
they,
ends.
Yeah, it's
just like The Mist.
but yeah, I would say also probably watch Solaris before you watch Stalker. I watched Stalker. I'll tell you the kind of headspace I was in to enjoy it. I don't know if that helps, but I mean, I got really into my wine club during lockdown. I was building a 3D printer, other than like this, and I was really into questions about what new ideas you can gain from going in circles or being in mediocre or destitute places. Where's the hope to find a new idea? Which is very much what lockdown felt like to me.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a movie about people who reveal incredibly deep ideas walking through a toxic waste dump. And it's sort of like, well, if they can find that, if they can find enlightenment from this, like the thing I told myself was like, surely I can find my own personal development. You know, I had no roommates, no partner. I was living alone by myself. Like, surely I can get something out of that, yeah. You know? So
I'm glad I experienced it.
Yeah.
Truly. This is like the gateway drug for more Tarkovsky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I want to watch this, his other shit.
Yeah. You could watch every, because then you're in Italy and you're like, well, at least it's in Italy. Italy's kind of nice. You know, and it's interesting because the most
at least I'm in space. Space is nice.
Yeah, it's interesting. Tarkovsky thought the most beautiful thing of Italy was the sky, the color of the sky.
Sure.
He was like, I get how their relationship with the land is, just looking at how clear the arid sky is. So
it's like a prisoner getting out of jail. Oh, my God. Or like that scene in Room where they leave the room for the first time and they see the magnitude of the sky and they're like, oh, my God. Wow. Yeah. That's like Tarkovsky leaving Russia. Like, well, oh, my God. Like, the sky's blue.
Yeah. Wow. That's like every scene of Tarkovsky is like, hang on to this little nugget of goodness in a bleak world. Andrei Rublev, in my opinion, is way worse about this. I don't think I've finished that movie. I've gotten through, I've started rewatching it like 6 times, and I've gotten through different amounts. Mm-hmm. And the scene with the peasant playing the music and they run into the aristocrat, great scene, but I was like, oh, I gotta watch that. It was longer than Stalker. And it's not even like a cool science fiction concept. It's like, hey, the Middle Ages are full of assholes. Ta-da. Like, you fucking knew that. Like, innovation is the work of the devil. Like, like, what the hell is that? You know, so
I gotta tell you guys, there's these mixed reviews of if I should watch this movie is making me really feel like I should wait for a rainy day when I really don't have much else to do.
All I'm saying, Diego, is that you saved 3 hours of your life.
Oh shit.
No, hey. Okay, if you like Wong Kar-wai and you like Stanley Kubrick, then give Tarkovsky a shot.
I've seen maybe, I don't think I've seen a Wong Kar-wai movie, which I maybe kind of.
I mean, you saw Everything Everywhere all at once.
That's not.
There's some scenes that are inspired by Wong.
Yeah, they rip off of it.
I was
short round smoking that cigarette. Wong Kar-wai.
I mean, for Fallen Angels, half watched it, no sound, and then for Stanley Kubrick. Oh, I'm gonna. No, he did 2001, Clockwork Orange, and Full Metal.
Full Metal Jacket.
Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah.
Haven't seen Eyes Wide Shut.
People overplay how much sex is in that movie. Weird statement to make, but like that was the
big, I mean, it's a big
it's about the elites and their you know.
Yeah, and there's like
sex orgies.
Yeah, and it's like there's like two naked chicks that are like doing weird drugs at rich people parties and you're like
Sounds like a lot of exhibitions.
You see Nicole Kidman's ass.
Okay.
Yeah, but
that's a cold open.
Okay, but it's like a married couple having like sex in their bedroom. And then they smoke some weed and they're both like successful professionals. And in 2024, you're like, yeah, that's like half the people I know. Like what? Like,
Diego, it's about the Illuminati. They're pulling the strings behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They're doing sex rituals.
Oh shit. Okay.
But after like the Da Vinci Code made it look like chopped liver. If you've read the Da Vinci Code, like this movie's just kind of like somebody who's never read the Da Vinci Code who comes up with a bad version of the Da Vinci Code, in my opinion. Like,
are you saying Eyes Wide Shut is bad?
I thought it was the most disappointing Stanley Kubrick film I've seen.
I'm going to say it right now. It's the film that got him killed.
Oh, I wish. No.
You think it was diabetes that got him killed?
No, I think him trying to write the AI movie is what like got him killed.
Oh, shit.
What AI movie? What
have you ever
Steven
seen
Spielberg's
movie with
AI?
Yeah, Haley Joel Osment, the kid from Sixth Sense, is a robot who wants to be a real boy.
I fucking like that movie.
And no,
it's a modern retelling of Pinocchio.
Okay, but
we
all
are
the
so
best.
Off topic.
Is that the one where like the kid is at the bottom of like he's
the well frozen or whatever?
Yes.
Yeah, and then he gets uncovered by these like future sentient like beings. I remember. Okay, that's so crazy because I was trying to. I just have these
core memories.
Like these scenes, like these core memories of this movie from when I was younger, and I'm like, why can I not remember what it is? And now that I think about it, and why it's such a core memory is because I mean, I don't know. I guess you kind of think about being a fleshy human, and all you can think about is, I wonder what like. All of this is going to be like in the, I don't know, a million years or whatever. So,
okay, listen. Is our next movie going to be AI?
I think our next movie, we should walk it back and do like something more accessible, close to the Chungking Express.
Chungking Express?
No, Chungking.
I love you, Mike, but you picked this one.
Armand suggested.
No. You're like, let's do Starter.
Yeah, and Mike,
like,
you
okay.
texted me.
Okay.
Hey, I want to shoot you, Armand.
I thought the original suggestion I made like a year ago to watch Stalker. If you guys noticed,
you're like, let's
months,
watch an Iranian movie, and I was like, yeah, let's do it. And then last minute, let's do Stalker. And
you
I was
texted
like,
me,
okay.
Mike, saying I'm gonna bring up to Armand that we're gonna watch Stalker.
It was right after we watched Dune.
I know. Yeah. Okay.
Let's watch.
Okay. Wait.
I was like,
Do you not remember in the bar where I was like, what? I suggested.
Hey, do you remember the thing I said while we were all drinking? Oh, yeah. Sorry. I'm so sorry. You kind of gave me a look and I'm like, yeah, okay. That was a dick thing to say. But like, you know, we're just poking fun.
But I stopped.
You also said anything that's chicken is a chicken nugget.
Chicken tender.
Any chicken that is breaded and fried. Where is the line that chicken tender becomes a chicken nugget? Is it like under 2 inches?
It has to be a nugget.
Yeah, it has to be like, you know, like something.
Because when you're mining for gold back in the gold rush, they're looking for nuggets.
Nuggets.
Nuggets aren't this big.
There are gold nuggets the size of chicken tenders, man. Like,
but it still has a soft spherical
that's
look
a chunk
to it.
Of gold
so
at that
you
point
cut
it's not a nugget.
Chicken breast to be spherical and breaded and shit, can you say it's a chicken nugget even though it's bigger than like McDonald's chicken nuggets?
Oh, it's a chicken God. Chunk
we're so often
wait yeah. It's like the McChicken or the Popeye's chicken sandwich, you remove the bread
the
and
next
like
movie we're gonna do is The Founder, which is about McDonald's, which the chicken nugget will be in there, and we'll see how big they are.
I've seen The Founder. I've seen that one. Okay, sick.
I've seen it in disorganized clips on TikTok. I don't know if that counts.
We're gonna get some McDonald's and measure the nuggets, and that's how big a chicken nugget is.
Remember, there's two kinds. Like, there's two shapes of the nuggets. Like, that's it. It doesn't deviate much more out of that.
It's a chicken nugget, chicken tender, mm-hmm. and then the chicken breast.
I think McDonald's chicken nuggets are just a form of popcorn chicken, ultimately.
Popcorn chicken.
Now he's reading popcorn chicken. Yeah, that's...
You guys like, here's
how big is a popcorn now?
The tender, then the finger, then the nugget, then the popcorn chicken. And essentially somebody just made
he's gonna
the
bring
same
up chicken
food
fries
in different portions.
Yeah, why don't you, let's, you know, get on your shit. Talk about chicken fries. What are your
chicken
thoughts
fries?
On that? Yeah.
Well, I'm the one arguing they're all interchangeable. I say you can call a chicken nugget a chicken fry. You can call a chicken tender a chicken fry. You can call a chicken tender a chicken finger.
The point I'm trying to make is is that, Mike, you suggested Stalker.
Yes.
Now it's Diego's turn.
Oh, sick. Wait, I felt like I selected...
I know, you suggested 65.
Right.
And that was an awful time.
That was funny. That was so... I was literally thinking about that on the way here, and I was like, man, remember 65? God, I can't believe we watched that. Oh, we did see Ultraman, though. That was fun. I liked Ultraman. It was cute.
That's true.
Is oh, but turn? We were supposed to... Yeah, I think it is your... I feel like it is your turn.
I want to be on the Tarkovsky train still and do...
Ivan's Childhood would probably be the most accessible.
Honestly, I've been saying that for a while.
I
want to see
showed
Ivan's
this
Childhood.
Movie to a guy who hated this and loved Ivan's Childhood, but he also loved war films, so that's the caveat I'll give.
Ivan's Childhood was the one where the kid befriends the three soldiers. That's where the video...
He's a scout that does commando missions behind enemy lines because his parents got killed by the Nazis and he just doesn't give a fuck anymore.
I should say we should watch Come and See. Fuck both of you.
Oh, what's that? Man, it is
the horrors of war.
It's considered the most emotionally difficult war
it
film
makes,
to watch.
It makes Saving Private Ryan look like Barney.
Okay.
Yeah, it makes Thin Red Line look like a U.S. Army commercial.
Are we going to talk about these and then end up picking something else? It might happen. It's okay.
Next time, we watch Dune 3.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, we probably should have watched Ivan's Childhood before this movie because...
It's okay.
You know, Ivan's Childhood still has some pacing like just a regular 50s, 60s film. Mm-hmm. You know?
Should we just watch The Seventh Seal and be done with it?
I know how it ends.
I feel like we should watch FMJ next. I don't know why.
Fuck Mary Jane. What are you saying?
Full Metal Jacket.
I mean, if I could offer like a separation, A is like a normally plotted movie with a lot to talk about. That was why I recommended it. It's like 12 Angry Men.
We talked about it for 2 hours. So, yeah, there's a lot to talk about with Stalker.
But I talked way too much this episode. I mean, let's just be real. I was like dominating a little.
I was feeding you the questions, so.
True. But
I didn't watch it.
Yeah, but I feel like a dialogue heavy movie with a lot to talk about in the plot, like a Separation or
let's watch Separation. The Iranian movie that we were originally going to watch.
Okay, we can even make it 2 or 3 down, but I'm just saying that if we watch another Tarkovsky film, 100% Ivan's Childhood.
Thank you.
Should be the next one. Look at the oil. Look at the fish. Look at the
guys. This has been real.
Mm.
We'll debate it offline.
Yeah.
All right.
Sounds good.
Fair enough.
Stay tuned to the next one, though. Thanks for sticking with us through this whole ride.
Be sure to watch it next time.
I got you guys. Don't you worry.
It's
been real, guys. Thank you so much.
Of course.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. Thank you, Diego.
Thank you.
It's been real. Until next time, stop that scroll. Spend more time watching. Bye.
That's it for this time on The Syndicate. We hope you enjoyed yourself. Keep the conversation going by adding us on Instagram and Letterboxd, where you can catch Armand along other podcasters and listeners at Syndicate. And until next time, stop that scroll and spend more time watching. Goodbye.